Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a look at a case that, honestly, it feels like it's straight out of an urban legend.
It really does. It's one of those stories that blurs the line between, you know, true crime and something else, something more like psychological horror.
Exactly. We are digging into the really disturbing events that happened to a man named Microphone back in 1974, Greenbow, Alabama.
A case a lot of people know online as The Puppet Under the Bed.
And that title, it really doesn't even begin to capture the level of planning and, frankly, the cruelty involved here.
No, it doesn't. Oh. We've been through all the source material on this.
Yeah.
The narrative accounts, the police reports, the timeline. And one phrase just keeps jumping out.
I know the one you mean.
Yeah. Even in the official write-ups, it's described as having to be one of the most evil things ever done.
And they're not talking about violence, not in the typical sense. They're talking about the sheer psychological warfare.
Right. It wasn't hyperbole. It was an assessment of this incredibly meticulous campaign of terror.
So that's our mission for this deep dive. We're going to follow the timeline exactly as it happened to Mike, from that first night in his new house all the way to that horrifying final discovery.
And we really have to focus on the process, the way the intruder slowly, carefully convinced Mike that the threat wasn't real, that it was all in his head.
That's the whole crux of it, isn't it? The entire thing was designed to make the victim doubt his own sanity.
It's the ultimate trap. Mike was convinced he was having some kind of breakdown, seeing hallucinations, when the reality was so much simpler and so much worse. The intruder didn't need a weapon, not really.
No, he just needed to find the cracks in Mike's reality and just push.
He used Mike's own mind against him.
All right, let's get into it. Let's set the stage. So the year is 1974. A man named Microphone makes a big move to Greenbow, Alabama.
And it's important to understand why he moved. He wasn't looking for a big city, for excitement. He took a new job, and he was specifically looking for a fresh start.
The classic clean slate. He wanted peace and quiet. He wanted to get away from whatever was going on in his life before.
And he found what he thought was the perfect place. The sources are really specific about the house he bought. It was described as quiet, isolated.
But it's more than that, isn't it? It's the degree of isolation that's so key here.
Oh, absolutely. The text says it sat miles from the nearest neighbor.
Miles. Ooh. Not just down the street, not at the end of a cul-de-sac. We're talking about true rural isolation.
And you can see why that would appeal to him, right? If you want a fresh start, what's better than total privacy? No nosy neighbors, just peace.
But that selling point, the very thing he was looking for, immediately becomes his biggest liability.
It's a catastrophe in waiting. That isolation becomes the perfect incubator for what's about to happen.
Because there's no one to hear you scream, obviously, but it's more than that.
It's about validation. If you have a neighbor right next door and you see something weird, you can, you know, call them up. Say, hey, do you see that light? Did you hear that noise?
Right. You have an external check on your reality.
Exactly. But when you're completely alone, miles from anyone, and something strange happens, what's your first instinct?
Your mind starts looking for internal explanations.
It has to. It's almost easier for your brain to believe you're overtired or stressed or even that you saw a ghost.
Yeah.
Than it is to accept that a real physical person has managed to get inside your isolated fortress and is now, what, just playing games with you.
That seems too bizarre, too calculated, so you tell yourself you imagined it.
And the intruder is counting on that. He understands that basic human psychology.
So we get to night one. Mike's probably exhausted, you know, from moving all his boxes, getting settled. He's walking to his bedroom in his brand new, peaceful house.
And that illusion of a fresh start just shatters.
Yeah.
In an instant.
He sees something.
The first appearance is so minimal, it's surgically precise. He sees a head peeking around the hallway corner.
Just a head.
Just a head.
Okay.
And the description we have is chilling because of how simple it is. Just a pale face watching him.
No body, no sound, no movement other than just peeking.
And that detail is the absolute genius of this whole terrible plan. A pale head. It's not a guy in a ski mask, right?
If he'd seen a man in a ski mask, he would have grabbed a phone, called the police, maybe grabbed a baseball bat. The threat would be clear.
But this lands right in that uncanny valley. It's not clearly a person. It's not a monster. It's just this disembodied, pale thing watching.
The ambiguity is the weapon.
It's the whole game. Because it forces Mike's brain to fill in the blanks. And what does a stressed out guy, alone in a new house, conclude?
That he's seeing things.
Exactly. And his reaction proves it worked perfectly. The source says he was terrified. Of course he was. But what does he do?
He doesn't investigate.
No. He tried convincing himself it was just exhaustion and ignored it.
He actively works to disbelieve his own eyes.
He has to. It's a defense mechanism. He's just made this huge life change, pinned all his hopes on this house, this fresh start, to admit on night one that there's a real physical threat inside with him.
Means the whole thing is a failure, that he's made a terrible mistake.
So it's easier to blame himself. To say, the problem is with my perception, not with my reality. He protects the idea of the house by sacrificing his trust in his own senses.
And the stage is now perfectly set for the intruder to just turn the screw.
And he doesn't wait long. The very next night, he goes for it again. Because for this to work, it can't be a one-off. It has to be a pattern.
Right. Mike's probably trying to put it out of his mind. He's sitting down, trying to relax, maybe watching TV, as the source says. He's attempting to create a sense of normalcy in the house.
He's actively fighting the memory of what he saw, trying to convince himself it was a trick of the light, a product of exhaustion.
And then it happens again. But the location shift is so important.
It's brilliant. It's not in the hallway this time. He looks over, and the same head is now staring at him from the kitchen doorway.
It's moved deeper into the house. It's in the main living space with him now.
And it's not just a quick peek this time. It's staring. It's more confrontational. It's watching him while he's trying to be at ease.
The first time, he was moving, walking down the hall. This time, he's stationary. The head is the only thing that's different.
And that repetition, that confirmation that it wasn't a one-time thing, that's what breaks him.
The denial just collapses. He panics.
Total panic. He doesn't rationalize this time. He doesn't try to ignore it. He grabbed his keys and spent the night at a motel.
He flees his own home.
Like, about what a huge step that is. He abandons his sanctuary, the symbol of his new life, and pays money to sleep somewhere else, all to get away from something he still probably suspects is just in his own head.
From the intruder's perspective, that's a massive victory. He's proven he can drive Mike out of the house without ever showing his full body or making a direct threat.
Exactly. He's confirmed the power of the puppet. But the next morning, that's when the outside world gets involved and unwittingly becomes the intruder's greatest ally.
He goes to work and he tries to talk about it. He tells his coworkers.
He's looking for that validation we talked about, right?
Mm-hmm.
He needs someone to say, wow, that's terrifying. You should call the police.
But that is not what he gets.
Not even close. The account says they laughed it off, saying he probably needed a psychiatrist.
Oof. In 1974, that's not just a casual joke.
No, the stigma around mental health was intense. It's basically the most invalidating response possible. They're not just saying, we don't believe you. They're saying, the problem is you. You are defective.
So his one attempt to reach out for help just pushes him further into isolation. They reinforce the exact narrative the intruder wants him to believe.
It's another example of the intruder's genius. The ambiguity of the puppet is what makes this possible. If Mike had said, a man with a knife was in my kitchen, they'd have called the cops themselves.
But because he says, I saw a pale head staring at me, the immediate reaction is to question his sanity, not his safety.
The intruder basically created a crime that society's framework at the time couldn't process as a crime. It gets filed under mental illness, and the physical threat remains completely invisible.
And Mike buys into it completely. He's been shut down so hard by his coworkers that he internalizes their diagnosis.
He does. The source says he actually went to a psychiatrist.
Wow.
That's the moment he fully accepts the premise. The problem is not an intruder in his house. The problem is a malfunction in his brain. The external world told him he was crazy, and he believed them.
He's now actively trying to solve a home invasion by treating it as a personal mental health crisis.
Which is exactly what the man under his bed wants.
And then things go quiet.
Yes. This next part is maybe the most calculated and patient move in the entire sequence. A week passed with nothing unusual.
A whole week of silence.
If the sightings had kept happening every night, Mike might have eventually broken. He might have gone to the police, psychiatrist or no psychiatrist, and insisted something was wrong. But the pause. The pause is a masterstroke.
What does it do psychologically?
Two things, perfectly. First, it gives him a profound sense of false security. He thinks, okay, I went to the doctor, I'm dealing with my stress, and the hallucinations have stopped. It's working.
He believes he's getting better.
He believes he has solved the problem. And second, and this is the really insidious part, that week of quiet retroactively validates his belief that it was all in his head.
Right. The silence proves the theory. The problem was me. I took steps to fix me, and now the problem is gone.
He is now more convinced than ever that the threat was internal. He's been conditioned. The intruder let him feel safe again, just so he could pull the rug out from under him one last time.
It's an incredible risk, though. A whole week where Mike could have installed locks, bought a dog, told someone else who might have taken him seriously.
A huge risk. But the psychological payoff was bigger. He was priming Mike for the final act, training him to disbelieve his own eyes no matter what they showed him.
And that brings us to the final confrontation. After a week of peace, when Mike feels like he's finally in control, he wakes up.
He wakes up in the middle of the night, and he sees the head again.
But the location.
The location's everything. It's not in the hallway. It's not in the doorway. It's standing at the end of his bed.
The ultimate violation. The intruder has finally entered his most private, most vulnerable space, the bedroom.
He's in the room, right there. Inches away, really. The peak of the escalation.
And Mike's reaction, his internal monologue, it shows that the week of conditioning worked perfectly.
He's shaking. He's terrified. But the source says Mike told himself it wasn't real.
Even with it right there at the foot of his bed.
Even then, he doubles down on the hallucination theory. He decides this is the moment he has to fight back against his own mind.
Mm-hmm.
He resolves to force himself to confront the hallucination.
It's unbelievable. His survival instinct is screaming, danger, flee. But his conditioned intellect is saying, this is a phantom. You must be strong and face it.
He's been so thoroughly manipulated that he is about to willingly move toward the danger, armed with nothing but the false belief that it's a creation of his own psyche.
He's walking right into the trap.
So this is it. The moment where this entire psychological illusion either holds up or completely disintegrates.
Mike is in bed, staring at this pale head at the foot of it, telling himself, it's not real, it's not real. And he decides to confront it.
He forced himself to confront the hallucination, leaned over the edge of the bed, and froze.
That's the moment. The moment the story flips from a ghost story into something else entirely.
Because he sees what's really there. And the source material is so blunt, so chilling about it.
There was a man underneath holding a puppet, the same head he'd been seeing for days.
A man under his bed the whole time.
The horror just, it doesn't just change. It transforms into something so much worse. It's no longer an abstract fear of ghosts or insanity. It's the concrete, physical, immediate terror of realizing you are in a room with a predator who has been living under your bed, tormenting you for over a week.
The head wasn't a ghost. It was a prop. A tool.
And it had a body attached to it, a person who was physically there, just inches away while he slept. And now you understand that, quote, one of the most evil things ever done. It wasn't just a home invasion. It was a dedicated, full-time project to systematically dismantle a man's sanity.
Think about the logistics of it. This guy, who we later find out is Buddy Light, had to be living in the house.
He must have had a hiding spot, a way to get food and water. He was probably only moving around when Mike was at work or when he fled to that motel.
The level of premeditation is just staggering. He had to source or make this puppet. He had to scout the house. He had to be willing to lie still under a bed for hours on end, night after night.
All for what? Just to scare him?
It's more than that. It's about psychological eviction. And the puppet is the key. Why not just wear a mask and jump out?
Because that prompts a physical fight. The intruder could get hurt. The police get called immediately.
Exactly. The puppet maintains the ambiguity. It allows the victim to do the work for you, to convince himself he's crazy. It lets the intruder inflict terror from a relatively safe, hidden position. He can just maneuver the trap on a stick from under the bed.
He didn't want to steal Mike's TV. He wanted to steal his mind. He wanted to break him so completely that Mike would just leave, run away and never come back, convince the house was haunted or that he was having a breakdown.
And the damage that does is so much deeper than a physical assault. To have your own perception of reality turned into a weapon against you, I can't imagine how you'd recover from that.
So Mike sees him. The reality hits him like a freight train. And what's his reaction?
Pure primal instinct, fight or flight. And he chooses flight. He's sprinted for the stairs.
He bolts. Just tries to get out of there.
And the intruder's reaction is just as horrifying. After being discovered, he doesn't just stand up and run. He starts crawling after him.
Oh, that detail is awful.
It is. He maintains this low, creepy, inhuman posture. He doesn't get up and chase him like a normal person. He crawls.
It suggests that's how he's been moving around the house, right? Staying low, out of sight. It's become his default state. He's not just a man in the house. He's the creature that lives under the furniture.
It makes the chase that much more terrifying. Mike is being pursued by the monster that lived under his bed.
So you have this incredibly tense, dramatic chase scene. This masterfully planned psychological campaign is reaching its physical climax.
And it ends in the most absurdly clumsy way possible.
All that planning, all that patience, defeated by a simple trick.
The source is very clear. But halfway down, the man slipped, tumbled, and blacked out.
He just falls down the stairs and knocks himself out.
The great architect of psychological terror, the puppet master, is taken out by a moment of simple bad coordination. The irony is just incredible.
The police show up and the whole thing is just over.
Yeah, they find him still unconscious at the bottom of the staircase. No struggle, no standoff. The whole complex horror story ends with a bump on the head.
And once he's in custody, they identify him, and the final piece of the puzzle clicks into place.
He's identified as Buddy Light, and he's not a stranger. He's the previous homeowner's son.
Ah, there it is. The motive.
It changes everything, doesn't it? This wasn't a random act. Mike wasn't just some unlucky target.
He was an obstacle. He was living in Buddy Light's house.
Buddy was a man who had never accepted that the house was no longer his.
So this wasn't about money. It wasn't about violence for its own sake. It was a crime of possessiveness, of a completely twisted sense of entitlement.
That house wasn't just a building to him. It was part of his identity.
Yeah.
And he felt it had been stolen. So he launched this unbelievably cruel campaign to get it back, not by buying it, but by making it unlivable for anyone else.
He wasn't trying to rob Mike. He was trying to haunt him out of the property.
Psychological eviction. He wanted to create a trauma so deep that Mike would flee and the house would be empty again. Presumably for him to, sneak back into. It's just a completely warped worldview.
The dedication to that goal, to terrorize someone so completely, it shows that his attachment to the property was more important to him than another person's sanity.
Or their life. This could have gone so wrong in so many ways. But for Buddy Light, the house is all that mattered. Mike was just in the way.
So when you look back at the whole sequence of events, it's just... it's the effectiveness of the strategy that is so stunning.
It is. Mike was so thoroughly convinced that the problem was him. He sought psychiatric help for a home invasion.
He was trained step by step to distrust his own senses. He was looking for a ghost, a sign of stress, something unreal.
All while the very real, very solid threat was hiding just below his line of sight. Hidden by his own bed, the one place he should have felt the safest.
The fear of that unknown thing, the pale head, it completely blinded him to the actual danger right under his nose. The puppet was the perfect misdirection.
It kept the police away. It kept him from taking real defensive measures. It isolated him completely. It's a dark lesson in how our own need to rationalize, to find a logical explanation, can be turned against us.
We'd rather believe we're losing our minds than accept that something so bizarre and malicious is actually happening.
Right. And it all boils down to that one single horrifying moment of realization for Mike. The whole story pivots on it.
If you had to distill this entire terrifying ordeal down to one core insight, what would it be?
The scariest part wasn't the head. It was realizing it had a body.
That's it. That's the whole thing right there. The moment the spectral becomes physical, the moment the fear becomes real.
It's the point where he understands this wasn't a random haunting. This was a personal, calculated attack that had been going on for over a week.
And that leads to the thought that we should probably leave everyone with.
We know the motive was this deep, toxic obsession with the house, this entitlement from Buddy Light.
So the question to really think about is, what does that take? What level of obsession and, I guess, grief does a person have to feel over a piece of property to make them do this?
To make them undertake this incredibly complex, prolonged campaign of terror against a total stranger. What does that say about what home means to some people?
That losing it could motivate you to completely destroy the sanity of the person who lives there now.
Yeah. It's not just a crime about a house. It's a crime about possession, loss, and an entitlement so profound that it sees other people as ghosts, as things to be scared away. That's maybe the most unsettling part of all.
Something to think about. If you want to see the full timeline and get more details on the case, we have all of that in our episode notes.
All the source material we work from is there. You can find it linked from @InspectorStory.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.